From the Annals of Thoracic Surgery and the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, welcome to Beyond the Abstract, part of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons Surgical Hot Topic Series. I'm Tom Varghese, a thoracic surgeon and deputy editor of digital media and digital scholarship for the Annals. This is a podcast all about the why behind articles and issues in cardiothoracic surgery and healthcare, and what are the planned next steps from authors and thought leaders in the field. We're glad that you are here. If you enjoy our program, please rate our podcast on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you downloaded this podcast. Your feedback is appreciated. On this episode, we speak with Dr. David Shaheen, cardiothoracic surgeon at Massachusetts General Hospital and professor of surgery at Harvard Medical School. He serves as the chair of the Council of Quality Research and Patient Safety at STS. Also joining us is Dr. Keith Nonheim, general thoracic surgeon at St. Louis University and current president of the STS. Please remember, the opinions expressed in this podcast are that of the individuals and not necessarily of STS. Today's topic is surgeon performance in adult cardiac surgery. This is an article that was published recently in the Annals of Thoracic Surgery. It really gives a great perspective of where the field has been, where the field is now, and where the field is going in the future. Dr. Shaheen, we'll start the question with you. The motivation for this project, obviously this particular editorial or article is talking about efforts made with the surgeon composite measure. But in your opinion, how much progress have we made over the years with this effort?
Well, first of all, Tom, I'm really proud of our specialty. We have been focused on both data collection and performance measurement for nearly three decades as a society. So we are very advanced, and our metrics, our risk models have all become much more sophisticated. Our benchmark population that we have available now is essentially every adult cardiothoracic program in the country. It's about 1,100 programs. So we have a huge benchmark population, which is very nice in terms of comparing results of a hospital or a surgeon with results all across the United States. Also very proud of the fact that we started voluntary public reporting in 2010, and that's been very successful. We now have about two-thirds of the adult cardiac programs in the country are voluntarily reporting their results, and these are not just process measure results. These are outcomes results based on really what we think are the best available metrics around for cardiac surgery. They're all peer review published. They're NQF endorsed. So two-thirds of the adult programs and over 70% of pediatric cardiac programs in the country. So extremely proud of that. We have historically focused our feedback efforts and our public reporting efforts in at the hospital or program level. We've done that for a number of reasons. Number one is the fact that when you have a hospital or programs cases, you have an adequate sample size to really get a good estimate of what their performance is. When you get down to the individual surgeon level, it becomes more difficult. Not impossible, but more difficult. So we, for a number of years, resisted doing that. And the other thing that many people bring up is that this is a team sport, and why should we be focusing just on the surgeon? But there's a flip side to those arguments. First of all, many patients do, in fact, want to select a surgeon, not just a hospital. Many patients. Most patients establish a very special relationship with their surgeon. That's not true of other members of the healthcare team. We have developed a metric which we think overcomes many of the issues that we've had with sample size in the past. So we have a very reliable multi-procedural measure. And we know from the development of our composite measure that results do vary across surgeons. So as a first step, we think that it would be very important for surgeons to have an idea of where they stand. What are the areas where they're doing well? What are the areas of opportunity for improvement? And there's one other aspect to this, and that is that although we've been perhaps a little measured in our rollout of surgeon-level metrics to surgeons, there are other entities out there that have been very aggressive about publishing surgeon-level results. Some of them are responsible, like several of the state report cards, New York, Massachusetts, that I'm involved in. Some of them are commercial entities that have neither published their methodologies for determining surgeon performance, nor have they gotten these measures endorsed by the National Quality Forum. And frankly, I'd say the results they report are somewhat problematic. So it's nice for surgeons to have a gold standard, highly reliable measure of their own performance should they need to counter any of these less ideal things that are being publicly reported. So, you know, as a start, we are basically right now talking about providing feedback to individual surgeons only of their results, and we'll see where it goes from there.
I think that's a phenomenal summary of all the efforts that have been made to date. Dr. Nonheim, do you think that the current manuscript is a call to action? And if you do believe that, what do you think are the next steps that the society or the organization as a whole should do in terms of standardizing these efforts across the nation?
Yeah, I'm not certain. It's actually a call to action that may be a little strong, but I do think it represents a heads up, if you will, for the practicing surgeon, a notification to the membership, alerting them of the next potential step for their own quality improvement programs. This is how they can work to get better. We believe surgeon-level composite represents a really good opportunity for every heart surgeon who participates in the adult database to take a critical look at their own personal results. As David suggested, we do know it's a team sport, and you can't have outstanding results without good performances by your anesthesiologist, your perfusionist, your intensivist, all the people working together. But it's also true, as Dave says, the flip side of the coin is they can't have good results unless you are a top quality surgeon and performing well. And there are times when we all fall short. We all know it in our heart of hearts. It happens anecdotally. It happens occasionally. It's pretty darn rare for most of us. But if there is a systematic problem with the way we're doing something, it will likely show up in this. And the feedback we get can allow us to look in the mirror, identify a problem, and then work hard to fix it. That's really what our patients deserve. The second part of your question had to do with
how do we get this standardized across? I mean, Dr. Shaheen had mentioned that it's amazing that we've made this progress in the world of cardiac surgery. But we don't see this in any other surgical specialty or anywhere else, and nothing even comes close. I mean, the three of us admittedly may be a little biased, but even objectively speaking, there's nowhere near the participation in a standardized database with that transparency of reporting that the STS database has. And so, you know, how do we keep the momentum going forward? How do we make sure that we have true transparency across the board, and how do we help other specialties as well?
Well, first of all, I think we got to get our own house in order and got to get people up and willing to participate. This surgeon-level participation is entirely new. Dave is absolutely right. We have some 94-95%, something like that, of the cardiac surgery done in the United States is currently reported into the database and utilized for ongoing quality assessment. But we're now going to have to see how many of our members we can convince to get this individual surgeon level feedback. I honestly think it's exceedingly important, and I think most of the people actually want it. We did do a survey, as you may remember. It's not published as of yet, but the vast majority of people really want to know their own results. And the first step is this is an opportunity to delve into our QI process, but I don't believe it should be mandatory. I really don't think that we should mandate people get this. When you do that, it's going to, I think, create a lot of resentment, some frustration. This is something that Dave and has also worked with, Rich Prager, worked very hard to put together a manuscript that will demonstrate the real value of this to the individual surgeon. They've got to want to do this. Anything you force on somebody, as you know, is it can be problematic. I want these surgeons to want to buy into this, to get their own quality information. And as you say, we're already miles ahead of every other specialty in terms of programmatic assessment and feedback. I don't think we really need to force people into this. I think they're going to, just as they have with the public reporting, I think they're going to see the value and gradually work their way towards this and want this information.
Now, the counter-argument to that, and this may be a question I'll direct back to Dr. Sheehan. You know, Dr. Nonheim, you mentioned about the downside of mandating. But Dr. Sheehan, you live in a state where there is mandatory reporting. Don't you think that helps if a mandate is in place in terms of at least prodding people to do the right thing? Or are the negatives associated with the mandate so much that we shouldn't embark on that effort?
Well, I've lived this experience. Back in 2000, the state legislature mandated public reporting of cardiac surgery outcomes in Massachusetts. They set up a commission, and I was elected to be the chair of that state commission at that time. We set up, it's very interesting, when that program started, there were only two of the, at that time, 11 programs in the state that were participating in the STS database. As part of the mandate, one of the requirements was that all programs had to collect their data in the STS database, and that data, those data were what were ultimately used for our public report card. Now, there was tremendous angst among the surgeons when this was being set up. We actually formed a Massachusetts Society of Thoracic Surgeons, which most states don't have, and it was primarily to make sure that the interests of the surgical community were represented in all these various discussions. And there was a lot of anxiety around the first report card or two. And frankly, over the years, there have been one or two outlier hospitals and surgeons, but very few. And what was initially very anxiety-provoking has now become very ho-hum, matter-of-fact. People are just used to living in that environment. Now, one thing the mandating does do, of course, is assure that 100%, not 67%, are involved in the program. But it does engender or have the capacity to engender suspicion, concern, perhaps a little more risk aversion when it's mandatory. We don't, as an organization, STS, does not have the ability to make something like this mandatory. We do not have the authority to do that. If a state wants to do it, they can do it. If the federal government wants to do it, they can do it. But we don't have that. We don't have that ability. But I will say, having lived in that environment for 16 years or whatever, the initial shock of having a mandatory public reporting program kind of wears off. And it's pretty much business as usual, and I think you'd find the same thing if you talk to people in Pennsylvania or New York or other states where they have mandatory public reporting at the surgeon level. And remember again that we're not talking now about public reporting, even voluntary public reporting for STS surgeons. We're talking about feedback initially, and you know, potentially in the future, public reporting, but one step at a time.
I hear you. Dr. Nonheim, the United States is a unique country in the sense that many hospitals, no matter where they're located, believe that they can truly do any and all procedures. But we see that in other countries, such as Canada, that there's only certain high-performing or centers of excellence that are allowed to perform some procedures versus the others. Is that one of the reasons why we have a mess right now in the U.S. in terms of the variation in outcomes, or is that is the issue is just so complex that you really can't drill it down to a simple point?
Well, I do think that is a problem myself. It really boils down to an issue of regionalization of care on the basis of quality outcomes. Actually, in Canada, as you know, it had to do, I think, just as much with, and I won't say rationing, but a limited availability of healthcare resources, so they couldn't have a CAT scanner in every street corner and a PET scanner in every hospital. So they have limited the resource, and their centralization came about as a result of their resource limitation. I'm not certain I can criticize people who are opposed to centralization. I'm not certain it's fair or unfair. I think just in 21st century America, it's just not really a realistic notion. There are so many stakeholders interested in the existence of multiple small, relatively low-volume hospitals, so most of whom do cardiac surgery. The stakeholders include the hospitals themselves, the surrounding civic communities, and the political people in D.C., the senators and congressmen who represent those stakeholders, and perhaps the most difficult faction to deal with is the American people themselves. As you know, they appear to believe that if they can get a Big Mac at the local burger stand, then they ought to be able to get a TAVR procedure at the hospital around the corner. They do not like the idea. They do not like the idea of regionalization of care. They essentially are very, very firmly against it. So whether we like it or not, I think the issue of access to care is just as important to the public as any other quality outcome. As you know, and it's a little frustrating to work hard to identify these subtle but real differences in outcome when if you tell a patient, you can stay right here at your local hospital, but the problem is your coronary artery bypass has a 4% mortality. If you will just travel 45 miles to the big city, you can have a 2% mortality. You can half the chance that you're going to die. And you know and I know, those patients don't go to the big city. They stay in the local place. They say it's only a 2% difference, no big deal. And what we consider to be a difference of a huge proportions, they just say, it's a couple of percent, and I like it here. My family can visit with me, and it's a local hospital. I'm going to stay. So the way we look at the necessities of quality improvement and the way we want to handle the issues aren't necessarily the same way that the public wants to handle it, and certainly not the same way that our political establishment wants to handle it. It can be a little frustrating for the docs involved.
Absolutely.
First of all, I think when we talk about regionalization, we really ought to be most interested in, first of all, new and innovative procedures where there's not a lot of experience, and secondly, the more complex procedures. It makes little sense for a program or a surgeon to be doing one or two or three or four of a pretty complex operation every year. It's just probably not going to achieve the ideal kinds of results. On the other hand, a very commonly performed procedure, regionalization, probably not so much of an issue. I think it's going to be the payers ultimately that may push the regionalization issue because through differential copay, centers of excellence, that sort of thing, they will have the ability to incentivize patients to go to regional centers for procedures where it appears that their morbidity and mortality would be less if they were in a higher volume institution. We know that better quality care is generally less expensive care if you can avoid complications. So it's in the certainly in the payer's best interest to try to direct patients of that type, the more complex or innovative procedures, to regional centers. So just another perspective on that question.
No, that's a great perspective as well. Dr. Sheehan, you had mentioned about how methodical this is in terms of generating these composite measures. You know, you really want to make sure it's risk adjusted. You want to make sure about the accuracy of the data. You go back for the current surgeon level composite measure, it's encompassing 3 years worth of data. How do you counter that with kind of the culture we have right now in the digital age where information is available at our fingertips, where everybody actually is seeking to have real-time performance outcomes? Is that just two efforts that are always going to be in opposition to each other, or do you feel that we're eventually going to get there where we can have accurate real-time reporting at the push of a fingertip?
Great question, and let me just take that in two parts. First of all, the issue of just how sophisticated and complicated these measures are. If you think about how surgeon or hospital level performance in, say, coronary bypass surgery was evaluated for years and still is in many places, it was just based on risk-adjusted mortality. The problem is that when you get down to mortality rates of 1% or so, it is very hard to differentiate quality based on risk-adjusted mortality alone at the kinds of volumes that most hospitals and certainly most surgeons have. And that was really the motivation for developing the whole family of composite measures that we have at the hospital level. First of all, we have started with our CABG composite, which has four domains: risk-adjusted morbidity, risk-adjusted mortality, use of at least one IMA, and use of all four NQF-endorsed perioperative medications. And then we added aortic valve, isolated aortic valve, AVR CAB, mitral procedures, and mitral CAB at the hospital level. Those are two-domain morbidity and mortality measures. And those measures, because they're composite measures, they effectively have more endpoints so that the reliability of those measures and their ability to discriminate levels of performance are much greater. Then you get the question of surgeon-level performance, and basing surgeon-level performance on just one procedure and one outcome, say CABG risk-adjusted mortality, it's very, very hard to make any sense of those kinds of numbers at the volumes that most surgeons have. So that's why we developed this individual surgeon composite, which is based on the results for five procedures that I just mentioned a second ago, weighted by the proportion of those cases that you do in your practice. If you're a mitral surgeon, that weights more. If you're a CABG surgeon, that weights more. Risk-adjusted morbidity and mortality, so two domains of performance, 3 years of data, and mathematically and statistically, it's a very sophisticated multi-level model. The first time we did this, running on a dedicated server, it took over a week for this to run and give us a conclusion. So it's a very sophisticated model. Then you ask the question, well, how close to real time can we get? It is impossible for us to do this kind of analysis at the surgeon level as frequently as we do it at the hospital level. At the hospital level, we've gotten really good. I'm very proud of this. For example, in 2018, this year, the closing date for our first data harvest was in the end of February, excuse me. And those reports on that data collection period, which went from January of 2015 to the end of 2017, those were available in June. So we've cut the lag period down tremendously. But we give the hospital level feedbacks four times a year. Twice a year, they have star ratings associated with them. We're only going to be able to do the surgeon composite because it's so sophisticated and takes so long to run. We're probably only going to be able to do those once a year to start. We may go to twice a year in another year or two, but right now we're just going to do it once a year. And the main limiting factor here is just the sample size issue. Remember, this measure is based on a running 3 years of data.
I also want to say that real-time, day-to-day, minute-to-minute, it probably isn't going to be a realistic expectation because there are some limitations in terms of resources. As Dave has educated me over the years, the real strength of this database is its veracity, its accuracy, the fact that we have trained data managers whose job is only job is to get the data, make certain it's accurate, make certain their standardized definitions are met, so that as we know, when you say it's crap in, crap out, that's what we have been guarding against for the past two decades. As you know, the programs are routinely audited. I think about 10% of the programs are audited every year, and they come back with 94, 96, 98% accuracy. That's the real value of this database and of this feedback, but that's not something you can achieve, you know, minute to minute. You do need people who are qualified and to look it over. Eventually, as you know, we will get some auto-population eventually of some database parameters directly from electronic health records. There are some demographics things that we can pretty reliably get in. But whether or not the patient actually had AFib now or had it post-operatively or whether or not it was a VTAC or whether or not there was actually a stroke or a TIA or were they just delirious, those are the kinds of things that you cannot easily harvest from an electronic health record. Those you need some of that judgment. You need those trained data managers, and that's not something unless you double the number of data managers or triple them. That's not something you're going to be able to get that information into the database on the same day reliably without hugely increasing your costs.
Sure, I think that makes all the sense in the world. But it also sounds like maybe. Do we as a specialty need to do a better job of educating the public on that aspect about why it's important to measure outcomes the way we do it?
I think we are trying to do that. I'm not certain we have the appropriate soapbox. I do know that whenever we have had the chance to interface with an Elizabeth Cohen from CNN or a Gina Colata from the New York Times, we've done our best to educate them regarding the way the database is put together, the care with which it's been constructed, and with which it's the data collection and assessment is carried out. Still, that's not something that is really sexy or that I think the public is going to be interested in. We can assure them of the quality, and I hope they'll believe it, but it's not something that's easy to convince everybody of on a widespread basis.
Dr. Shaheen, you had mentioned how, you know, one of the reasons why this may have resonated or started in our field is because mortality is obviously a huge outcome. And, I mean, there's no debate about that particular outcome, where when you go beyond mortality, it becomes sometimes tough to really tease out risk-adjusted outcomes. Do you think that's the reason why these efforts have been much more successful in cardiac surgery versus other specialties? Because our outcomes have, we're doing much more higher risk surgery?
Well, there's no question that this is the reason, this is one of the major reasons that it started in cardiac surgery. The whole outcomes movement started in cardiac surgery, is that we have well-defined outcomes, and certainly in the early years of cardiac surgery, the risk was much higher than it is today. Coronary bypass surgery, mortality rates were often 5% or even higher. And as I mentioned earlier, today they're down in the 1% range. So, but we do have a lot of well-defined outcomes that we can follow pretty easily. Did the patient live or die? Did they have a stroke? Did they have renal failure that required dialysis? Did they have a major infection of the breastbone that we often cut through for open heart surgery? Did they have to go back to the operating room for bleeding or some other reason? So those sorts of complications are pretty well defined, easy. Well, they're not easy to collect. We put a lot of resources into collecting them, but they are definable and reproducible. And so I think we do have an advantage in that area. But frankly, every area of medicine and surgery, there are some outcomes that could be measured. I don't care what disease process it is, if I came up with a medical or surgical problem tomorrow in an area that I didn't know much about, I would pick up the phone and I'd call a colleague in that area, and they could pretty quickly tell me who the best people were or the best institutions were to go to for that particular problem. How do they know that? Well, somebody within that specialty has a sense of what the outcomes are, and they just don't have the advantage of having a good database yet or having good metrics, but people in the specialty know. And I think that's what a lot of specialties are going through right now. They are realizing that if they don't do this themselves, somebody's going to do it to them, and they'll do it to them with inferior data, like claims data, and inferior methodologies that aren't validated. So I think we're way ahead of the game because we recognize the problem early on, and we have developed the best data around. We have the best methodologies, and we keep trying to improve them.
Dr. Nonheim, you had mentioned before that the STS, for example, as an organization, is limited in terms of what type of mandate or things that they can do. But as the current president of the organization, What is kind of your vision for these type of use of performance scorecards, database? What would you say could be the path forward for our organization?
Well, ideally, at least in this case, the surgeon-specific feedback and the rest of them, I'd like them to be used for the purpose they were intended. That is, programmatic and surgeon-specific feedback allow for early identification of quality issues where you're having a difficulty and you can address them summarily. It's really for quality improvement. That's the reason they were designed and put forth in the first place. What I hope they're not used for is are some of the episodes of public shaming or the program versus program marketing, my stars are greater than your stars kind of thing. Those activities, first of all, it's invalid to do that. That kind of direct programmatic comparison is invalid statistically from a standpoint because that's not the way the assessment is done. It is not made for direct comparison because each program, each person is assessed on their own particular profile of patients and risk factors. So you comparing me to Dave Shahian is absolutely invalid, though unfortunately that's what's done day in and day out. That's why some programs are a little hesitant to jump in with both feet and to participate. Plus the public shaming that's occurred is really not the reason the whole database was set up. It was set up so that we can give feedback to ourselves, identify problem areas. Is your urinary tract infection rate too high this month? Or are you taking longer to get them off the ventilators than you should? You can identify those little blips, those red dots, and say, damn, and concentrate your quality improvement efforts there and make it better. It should not be a punitive program. That's not what it's meant to be. It's supposed to be an educational one, a collaborative one that allows you to bring your results right back up to snuff to where they're as good as anybody else's in the country. So my vision for the future is to do just that, to use these scorecards to maintain high quality in each and every program in the country.
Beautiful. Well, we have a few moments left. From each of you, any closing thoughts or remarks that you want to have to the listeners to this podcast? Dr. Sheehan?
Well, I think that what STS has always been focused on, and I hope in the future will always be focused on, is giving our patients the absolute best quality care and outcomes that we can. And we believe that having good data and providing surgeons with and hospitals with their own benchmark results for their particular type of patients, that's one way to move that along and to continually improve quality. I think Dr. Nonheim has characterized it exactly right. That's the goal of this exercise is not to generate a bunch of measures. The measures are simply a means to an end, and the end is continually improving the care that we provide to our patients.
Dr. Nonheim?
I can't say much better than that. I if there are members of the public listening, I hope that they recognize that the society has put tens of millions of dollars and literally hundreds of thousands of man hours into putting together the best possible system for program improvement, that there are many people at every hospital you go to that's doing heart surgery, many people whose only goal in life is to provide the best quality care to all the patients that they see. And we're doing that not just prospectively, but we look retrospectively back. We assess our own results, and by doing that, get feedback that will allow us to yet improve the care, to maximize the chance that they will get in the hospital and out of the hospital safely and have their cardiac surgical problem addressed. It really, in the end, is all for the patients.
On behalf of all of our listeners, I wanted to thank you both for the vision behind this effort, and thank you for all the outstanding work that you do. Join us next time as we continue to explore and debate issues beyond the abstract, part of the Surgical Hot Topics series. You can connect with the Annals of Thoracic Surgery online at annalsthoracicsurgery.org or on Twitter at annalsthorsurge.